Hi, guys. Before we get started with today's episode of Sampler, I have a quick announcement to make. And so with me in the studio today is Gimlet CEO and co-founder Alex Bloomberg, and he is here to make the announcement with me.
I am.
So I guess, like, to get down to business, the big announcement is that this is the last episode of Sampler.
I can hear the cries of no! Yeah. And what I want to make clear is that it's not the last episode of you. This is the last episode of Sampler. Mm-hmm. Sampler is ending.
True.
Brittany Luce is here to stay and get bigger and stronger. More Brittany. Yes, exactly. So we're making this the last episode of Sampler to basically clear the decks so that we can develop a bold new project with you.
Bold. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Yeah. And listeners, don't unsubscribe, because we'll be using the Sampler feed to do some podcast curation and to keep you guys updated on what's next. But before we get to all that, I want to thank all of you for listening to Sampler week after week. Me and the Sampler team, we absolutely love our listeners, and we appreciate every single tweet and email and piece of feedback that you guys have provided throughout the past 9 months. We literally could not have done this show without you. We really love you guys, and it's been amazing going on this podcast journey with all of you. But we've done a lot of what we wanted to do with the show, and we're kind of ready for the next thing. So we've really enjoyed this time with you guys at Sampler, and we hope that you will join us on our next adventure.
Yeah. And I want to say I'm just incredibly proud of what you have accomplished on the show. I feel like every episode, almost, it's just been better and better. I've just been amazed at how you're connecting with your audience. And that's why we want to sort of build on the success that you've had with Sampler and build a project that is around you and the team that you've built here.
Thank you. I'll take that.
Thank you. So what can you tell everybody about your new show?
The details are very, very under wraps right now. It's obviously still in development, so we're working on it, but we do have a name.
Yes.
Brittany on the Loose.
Brittany on the Loose.
I think there are a lot of directions that we can go in.
Yeah. Because of your last name.
Because of my last name and my first name.
Right. Brittany.
Yeah.
On the Loose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. What other things could you do? Loose screw, loose cannon. Loosing my mind.
Loosing my mind. That's kind of a stretch.
I've never really thought about this, but your name can really...
I know.
It's very flexible.
I'm sure
you've thought about it.
No, most people stop at loosey-goosey.
So we have a name. We're working on a concept.
Yeah. So listeners, please stay subscribed. New things are definitely coming your way.
You're going to be sending people previews of Brittany on the Loose.
Yes. Previews of Brittany on the Loose. So that's all the news that we have for now.
That's enough news. So that's a big amount of news for our listeners before the podcast.
I think it's a big
But we do have one final podcast of Sampler for you guys to enjoy.
Yes. So without further ado, here is the finale episode of Sampler. From Gimlet Media, this is Sampler. I'm your host, Brittany Luce, and today's episode is all about true crime podcasts. So true crime is really popular, and for some, it's pretty controversial. One could argue that it's the genre that really brought podcasting into the mainstream. Like, you might be thinking about the first season of Serial, which investigated a murder and subsequent trial in Baltimore, Maryland. That particular show focused on the social issues surrounding a crime and its aftermath. And other shows on the true crime spectrum focus more on, like, the gruesome details of the crimes themselves. And for me, those are the ones that are especially difficult to listen to. And if you are like me, just a warning. Because we are talking about true crime in this episode, some of this stuff will be hard to hear. There are going to be mentions of sexual assault and violent crime, so please proceed with caution. So later in the show, we're going to focus on one true crime podcast in particular, one that's more on the Serial-style investigative end of the spectrum. But first, we are going to sample some of the other true crime stuff that's really gained in popularity so that we can understand the many varied appetites of podcast listeners. And as I've mentioned already, the more violent stuff is not really my personal cup of tea, so I have decided to enlist some help. The only person to appear on Sampler 2 times.
No way.
Yes.
Ah,
yes.
I'm in the 2-timers
yes.
club.
Yes, you are.
I'm so special.
Tracy, welcome. Welcome to Sampler.
Thank you for having me. I've missed you and your face.
I missed you too. I'm so glad that you're here. I'm like, we don't have any alcohol this time.
I forgive you. I forgave you when I walked in 10 minutes ago. I just didn't want to say nothing. But I noticed.
So Tracy Clayton is a writer at BuzzFeed, and she is one half of the podcast Another Round.
Mm-hmm.
But the main reason why Tracy is here today.
I'm so excited.
I'm so freaked out. I'm already stressed out about this. But the reason that Tracy is here today is because she is obsessed with true crime podcasts.
I am. I'm obsessed with true crime, like everything. True crime books, true crime shows. If I had a television and the only station was Investigation Discovery, I would be completely fine with that. I wouldn't even be mad.
It's not just you who likes these. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, like, there's a ton of people.
I mean, since true crime has kind of like really en masse come on the podcast scene, because I guess if you think about it, podcasts really blew up after Serial, which is true crime, but it's kind of more just like investigation.
Yeah.
But like the specific kind of true crime stuff that you're talking about, like, Now that it's kind of like entered the podcast world for real, I mean, it's blown up. Like,
it is.
Like, people are, it's not just you. People are obsessed with it, period.
Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a new true crime podcast every day. Like, I can't even listen to all of them
You can't
anymore.
Keep up?
I can't.
I just, why do you like it so much? Because it's full disclosure, like, I can't get into it. Like,
it's
just,
perfect sense.
It stresses me out.
I feel like that's the most logical response to horrible crimes, like murder and assault. That makes more sense to be like, I'm good.
But why do you like it?
This is actually a question that I always struggle to answer eloquently, because I can hear how, like, nuts I sound as I'm saying this. Uh-huh. But I think that my obsession with true crime comes from my anxiety over such horrible things happening in the world, uh-huh. right? So I have generalized anxiety disorder, which means I freak out about everything. So when I'm, like, reading the stories and watching all these crazy documentaries and now listening to true crime podcasts, in my head I feel like I'm preparing myself to keep something like that from happening to me, if only by, like, always having it on my mind, you know? So, like, when I pass somebody on the street that I don't know, like, I seriously assume that you could mean me bodily harm. Hopefully you won't, but just in case you do, like, my guard is up and, like, my neurons are, like, doing whatever, like, the protective neurons do, and I'm just like, okay, just be ready to run if you have to, because you never, ever, ever know. So there's that aspect of it. I'm also really obsessed with what happens in somebody's brain or their life that, like, makes them do these horrible, horrible things.
Oh, I never thought about it from that. I have no idea why, but I never thought about it from that point of view.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, it's really scary to think that, like, somebody's brain could just, like, fuck up as it's, like, being put together, and then, bam, they're a psychopath, and they can, like, murder people with, like, no conscience. And, like, as somebody who wants to have kids one day, I'm very interested in not raising a serial killer.
Mm.
And so, like, I'm really, really interested in, like, the childhoods of serial killers. Like, what happened to Ted Bundy, like, to make him just awful and terrible? How can I not treat my child the same way? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, my brain is always overly trying to keep catastrophe from happening.
Yeah.
And somehow I feel like this is a way, it feels like a tool for me. It feels like some kind of comfort. Like, I never get too comfortable when I'm, like, walking down the street by myself in the dark. You know, like, I'm just like, well, this reminds me of, like, that episode of I Killed Everybody that I saw.
Wait, that's a show?
No.
Oh.
It might as well be. Also, it's entertaining. Like, I also don't want to, like, minimize that aspect of it. It's easier to be like, I enjoy, like, thrillers, like suspenseful movies,
because
to say I enjoy hearing about these things happening in real life is, it's creepy to hear. It's uncomfortable to say.
Why is it uncomfortable to say?
Like, I know there are a lot of people who like true crime, but I also know that it's a very, like, specific sort of, like, fandom. And I feel like the average person that you stop on the street, you're like, hey, are you into serial killers? They'd be like, excuse me? You may be a little too into serial killers, because it's, like, a wild thing to, like, ask or wonder. But I think there's this fascination in every human with this thing that we just, like, can't control, that thing being, like, death in an unforeseen tragedy. You know, like, we can do our best to guard ourselves against it, but we really, you know, we just out here kind of waiting to be killed, sort of. That was depressing. I've tried so hard not to be creepy.
So true crime is kind of like your security blanket.
True crime is my security blanket. That's a perfect way to say.
So I heard you brought some clips.
I did.
With you today.
I would like to apologize in advance.
I'm a little nervous, but I mean, I'm not expecting like a full like 180 conversion.
Uh-huh.
But like, I'm brave.
Mm-hmm. And you're so brave.
I'm an intrepid host of Sampler.
Dedicated.
And I'm going to do this deep dive with you today, Tracy.
So the very first clip is from a show that I absolutely love called Criminal. It's hosted by Phoebe Judge. So Criminal, I like because it's very short. It was very well produced. And she often has interviews with people who are involved in the particular crimes. Mm. And it's important to note that not every crime that she discusses is like murder, rape, assault. Like sometimes it's just like people who are falsely convicted. Mm-hmm. I think there was an episode about like the vandalism of like a really sacred redwood tree. So like all kinds of like crimes get discussed on Criminal. I'm kind of drawn to the to the violent episodes.
Which
Shocker. Is, I know, it feels weird for me to say. This particular case was a really tough one to hear. And to everyone listening, you should know that this is going to contain graphic descriptions of a sexual assault. So please listen at your own discretion. So the crime itself happened in Anderson, South Carolina in 1983. And the first clip is an account of basically what happened in the initial crime. So you've got Phoebe Judge, and she's talking to Carl Anderson, who was the deputy chief of the Anderson County Sheriff's Office. He is one of the officers who got called into the Days Inn Motel, which is where the attack happened. And he got there and he found 23-year-old Elizabeth Daniel, who had just been, like, brutally gang raped. And here he is describing the scene and the crime and what he saw.
It's amazing. It's just a miracle that she survived, because the injuries are horrible, horrible.
She'd been raped by three men. She knew one of them, Roscoe Brown, very well. They'd had a child together, although Brown was married to someone else. When she went to the motel that night, she thought she was meeting only him.
And he wanted to break it off, and I think maybe she was asking for child support. So he, basically he did, I think he did this to discredit her, show that she was a person that would just go out with anybody. And he didn't intend for it to go that far, but everybody got drunk, and then the other boys, they just went berserk. The blood, the room was just, when I walked in, it was just bloody, blood all over the place. And, but she, they left, and she managed to get enough strength to make it to the lobby of the hotel and sat in a chair there, and it was just soaked with blood. She almost bled to death.
Elizabeth Daniel lost 4 pints of blood and was burned all over her body with cigarette lighters. Newspapers described it as a 6-hour act of unbelievable brutality. She was in the hospital for 5 days.
How you feeling?
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Yes. These moments are the hardest ones for me in like true crime podcasts and like true crime stories, is listening to like the actual harm that was visited upon the victims.
I was disturbed by the details, but I was very depressed by the fact that like this guy wanted to get out of paying child support.
Right.
So he decided to stage a gang rape so that people would just assume that this woman was of like loose morals.
Yeah.
And like, you know, and then she wouldn't be able to ask for child support. Like that.
There's so much going on there.
Yeah. Like that's just so fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Something that like I do find when I watch like true crime documentaries that I was able to like get into, it's just like sort of like how, or like what certain crimes and how they're received, like what that says about not just the person who committed the crime, but like how all of us feel
right.
about the person who like the crime was done against.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
For sure. When it comes to crimes against women, I feel like true crime stories can be such a stark indictment of like the society that we live in and the way that like our legal system sees and treats the act of rape itself.
Yeah.
Because like another component in this is that he, not only did he assume that if he could make her look like a promiscuous woman, that like that would get him out of child support, but like it didn't even seem to matter that, like, this was a violent sexual assault. It wasn't a consensual sexual act, you know? And, like, implicit in that is blaming the victim, you know? Well, oh, well, if she wasn't so loose, then she wouldn't have been in a position to, like, get hurt in this particular way. You know what I mean? Which is crazy. So the next part of the story is it just, like, made my brain melt. And I will tell you why. After the assault happened, the three men who were responsible for it were quickly found, and they all of them pled guilty, right? In a court of law, they said, yes, I did this horrible, awful thing. And so it comes time for sentencing. So the case went to a judge named C. Victor Pyle Jr. for sentencing. And in this next clip, we're going to hear a man named George Duckworth, who was a solicitor on the case at the time, and that's kind of like being the district attorney. So here's George Duckworth talking about Judge Pyle's very unusual sentence.
I mean, nobody really expected that sentence. I mean, we weren't prepared for that sentence.
Here's what happened. First, Judge Pyle told the court it was the worst rape case he'd ever seen. And then he gave the men a choice. They could serve 30 years in prison, that was the maximum at the time, or spend no time in prison and undergo surgical castration.
There was just dead silence in the courtroom for a moment when he handed that down, and I think a lot of people looked at each other wondering if they'd heard it right. But then, after a short time of silence, and there was a lot of talking going back and forth then, people really surprised at the sentence.
Were you surprised?
I was not totally surprised, because I'd talked with the judge earlier, and he'd read the pre-sentence report, and I didn't know the judge that well. It was the first time we'd had him, and I asked him if he'd decided on a sentence yet for the people, and he mentioned then that he thought about castration, but I didn't say anything else. I didn't know what to think of. I thought he was kind of kidding at that time, but when I heard it in the courtroom, I knew he was not kidding.
Have you ever heard of, have you ever been in a courtroom where you've had such an odd choice given, anything odder than that?
No, I don't think so. No.
I mean. Right? I'm very interested in what your initial thoughts and reactions are.
Well, you know, I am kind of relieved at this sentencing. I feel like a lot of the time, most people who like report rape and even like get to a courtroom, the person who they're accusing like likely doesn't get convicted. And if they do get sentenced, a lot of times it's a much lower sentence than what one might think is appropriate. So like the fact that he said, you can spend 30 years in jail or I will cut off your balls. That, like, I kind of appreciate the severity of that sentencing. It kind of, like, I felt like the judge sort of, like, took a moment to, like, just, like, make really clear for these guys, like, how much you abused and brutalized this woman. And not letting them off the hook for it, which happens
every day.
Yeah, all of the time.
So my understanding is that surgical castration would lessen greatly the desire for the men to have sex or to get an erection. It wouldn't completely, like, get, like, you can still, like, have sex once you've been surgically castrated. It's just, like, not as easy, I would assume.
It seems more challenging.
Seems like it would be a little tougher.
I think so.
But I feel like the fact that he considers a man not being able to have sex anymore for the rest of his life, as harsh a sentence as being removed from, like, the female population where you can't physically harm someone else, you know, like, it still comes down to, like, these men being stripped of their sexual pleasure, which I think colors rape itself as, like, a sexual act. And rape is not
about
sex.
It's not. It's about
power. Yeah, you know, it's about power. Like, they can still get out of prison and hurt women. They can hurt them in other ways. They can rape them with other things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then you've got that whole conversation to deal and contend with. You know, and it was just complicated. It was just a lot.
It is really, really, really complicated.
There's a lot going on.
Oh, there's a lot going on.
I know.
So true crime, like, freaks me out, and it makes me feel really uncomfortable. But, like, millions of people love it.
Yeah. So what makes you uncomfortable about it?
the things that make me uncomfortable about it are the same reasons why you like it.
Yeah.
To me, it makes me feel like it could happen to me. Do you understand? It could happen to anybody. And like, whereas for you, like thinking about it sort of makes you feel like you can kind of gird yourself against it.
Yeah.
Thinking about it makes, like, it would just make me so, like, too crazy.
Like, it just reminds you of, like, how, like, vulnerable we all are.
Yeah. Sort
of. I feel like Criminal is a good start of true crime podcast because not everything is so heavy and oppressive as our next show, which I have brought a clip from.
Oh, gosh.
My very, very, very first true crime podcast is still number one in my heart. It's called Sword and Scale.
Oh, my God. My boyfriend listens to this show.
Does he talk about it all the time?
I won't let him. I'm like, I'm too freaked out. Don't do it.
It's hosted by a guy named Mike Boudet. The tagline of the show is, "The worst monsters are real." So this is like, this is a heavy, heavy, heavy show. Like, there are times where even I have to, like, take a break
but
and, like, just pause.
Just heard was
I
heavy.
I know. Ugh. I'm trying to find a way to, like, even describe the show in, like, a not scary way.
Mm-hmm.
Every episode is its own story. So, like, often cases that I've never heard of, which is, like, a big appeal for me. Because once you, like, you know, you've spent, like, X amount of years consuming every true crime story, you hit a point where you're like, I know everything. Like, I know every serial killer story. This is a good podcast for, like, stories and, like, regional crimes that you've never, ever heard of, right? And he just gives so much detail. Like, he goes back and he gets archival footage. He has 911 tapes. He has interviews with people who are actually involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the show is edited in such, like, a sensational way. Like, he's got the creepy music in the background. And, like, his voice is kind of like, I can't do an impression, but, I mean, he's got a good true crime podcast voice, right?
I don't know what that means.
And the cases that he finds are, like, often really, really disturbing. This episode is a particularly, like, heartbreaking, just, like, tragic, tragic murder. It's going to be very difficult to listen to. It's very, very intense, so just please listen with discretion.
Uh-huh.
We've got two clips. In the first one, we're going to hear from Mike Boudet, so you can hear his sensational true crime podcast voice.
Right.
But the very, very first voice you're going to hear is that of Ken Coker. And he's a reporter at a local NBC affiliate, and he covered this story. It happened in a small town outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
I was just about to say, I know who Ken Coker is because he's from Michigan.
Snap.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
He's going to walk us through what happened with this case.
Connor Verkirky and his little brother Cameron and a little friend were out playing, just out playing in the mobile home park where they lived and kind of doing what normal boys do. And Jamarian Lawhorn, who's 12 and who lived a couple blocks away, didn't know them, but basically came up and introduced himself to them and asked if they could go play at the playground. And unbeknownst to the little boys, he somehow hid a knife, a large kitchen knife, in the sand in the playground. And while they were playing, he pulled out the knife and just started stabbing Connor Verkirky.
A 12-year-old boy stabbing a 9-year-old boy in a playground.
They made so many new friends this summer. They accepted everybody into their group.
This is Connor Verkirky's parents describing how that day Connor was trying to befriend the boy that would kill him.
10 minutes later, everything
fell apart.
Yeah.
What's even worse is that it was premeditated.
Yeah, he had hidden the knife in the sand. It's not clear to me whether he did it kind of while they were playing and he just sort of ditched it, but at some point he pulled that knife out and started stabbing Connor, and Connor and his little brother went running home, and the little brother's trying to help Connor home, and Connor ended up dying on the porch of his home.
Connor's little brother Cameron was just 7 years old when he watched his brother be killed. He could do nothing but watch and then try to get Connor back home. The two stumbled back before collapsing outside.
He grabbed him up under his arm, and basically they ran together.
Got all the way home, you know, bleeding, and the last thing he said was, you know, something like, you know, he told his parents he loved them and told his brother he loved them, and then he died.
He was saying that he loves us, and he kept trying to roll over so he could look at me and Jared. The last thing I heard him say was when they were wheeling him into the ambulance, he said, "Mama."
That's so sad. That's terrible. Sometimes, like, I feel like the story can sometimes come at the expense of the people's lives. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, their personalized. Sometimes I'm like, oh, my God, like, how does their family feel about this?
Yeah. That's a point of discomfort for me as a true crime listener, because I try really hard not to lose sight of, like, the victims and their families. Mm-hmm. And very often I, like, think about, what if it was, like, my family? And, like, those are the thoughts that really, like, I have to pull myself out of thinking like that. Because, I mean, that's, like, really what, like, shakes me up. But I do feel like it's to sit down and really consider, like, your interest in these stories, it's really uncomfortable. And, like, I don't want to make it seem like, you know, I love murder and death and everything is, like, fun. Like, you know, like, it does make me feel weird that these are things that, like, give me some sort of, like, comfort when these are things that have given other people, like, the families, like, so much, like, pain and, like, suffering. And, I mean, already there are, like, questions of, like, why and how, right? Like, what drives one child to, like, murder another child?
Yeah.
So I had mentioned that Mike Boudet often includes 911 calls. Uh-huh. I think they're fascinating to listen to. Sometimes they're too much for me to listen to.
That would be too much for me.
This one really, really sticks out in my mind, and I think it's pretty, like, you'll hear why. So right now we're about to listen to the 911 call that Jamarian makes after he stabs the little boy whose name was Connor. So he actually went to someone else's house, asked to use their telephone, called 911, and turned himself in. And this is the call.
Kent County 911, where's your emergency?
I have the address.
Hello, do you have an emergency?
Can I have a police officer at 5657 Madison?
So it's 5657?
Yes.
Okay. And what's happening there?
I just stabbed someone.
This is the 12-year-old, Jamarian Lawhorn, calling 911 from a neighbor's cell phone.
You did?
Yes.
Who was it that you just stabbed?
I don't know. I'm fed up with life.
You what?
I'm fed up with life.
Okay, did you stab yourself?
No. Well, I did take a whole bunch of pills to kill myself.
Okay, what's your name?
Jamarian Lawhorn.
What is your first name?
Come get me and lock me up forever.
Okay.
For life.
Okay, did you...
Take me to Jupiter. I don't want to be on this earth anymore. Kill me.
He did not really single out Connor. I mean, he was just chosen at random, some kid he didn't know. And, you know, he didn't run from police. He basically went to a home and asked them to call police, said he had just killed somebody, and he said that he wanted to die, and that's why he did it. He did it because he was hoping he might get the electric chair.
Hurry up and come kill me or take me to jail, do something. Inject me, how you do on movies. Give me an electric tray. I don't care how I die. They're going to come and kill me. Yes, I did it. Because I'm fed up with life and I want to die. I'm going to hell. I don't care.
I'm going to hell. I don't care, says Jamarian.
Because a lot. I'm so
what
sorry.
The fuck?
I know.
That's so sad.
It's so sad. It's so sad.
I mean, I just think about, like, Jamarian and, like, what I would... God, I'm sick.
Yeah.
He's 12?
Mm-hmm. He's 12. He's fed up with life. He wants to die.
If he's fed up with life and he wants to die, in general, I would say he probably has some, like, brain chemistry stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the first thing that I think of at that mm-hmm. age is what is happening at home.
Mm-hmm.
To say you're fed up with life, that's a very specific... He could have said anything else.
It's such a specific thing to say. And it's also, like, it's a thing that, like, Black people say when they've been on the earth and just been like mistreated for a long time, you know? He just sounds so like, he sounds like a child, but that sentiment is so old.
Being that weary is like, you don't earn that for some years.
Exactly. But for me as a Black person, I'm listening to this little boy saying he's fed up with life and he wants to die, like he's seen in the movies, and just like angry and like doesn't really have the words to describe it. And, like, you always wonder about, like, context, you know, because for a person who doesn't think about this stuff a lot, it's easy to be like, oh, well, he's just a bad kid and he did a bad thing and that's that.
Yeah.
But, like, you have to wonder about, like you were saying, like, what is the home life like? Is poverty involved, you know?
Abuse involved.
Yeah, abuse. Like, all of the things that, like, racism does to a child of color. Like, I feel like there's a particular lens that we have to, like, look at cases like this with. So as much as I love this genre, I think that one of the shortcomings is not thinking enough about race and how race plays into and factors a lot of crimes, you know? So I'm always really wary of these stories, like, just becoming entertainment. It's kind of like Cops.
Like Cops, a TV show.
Yeah. One of the big problems with Cops is that it just showed a whole bunch of, like, bad Black and brown criminals being caught and, like, justice being served and, you know, like, whether they're, like, you know, like stealing from like a store or something, you know, it's not, this stuff doesn't only happen because like these are bad, because criminals are bad people, you know, like there are like systemic like reasons that crime looks and performs differently in like the Black community.
This is,
it's so much.
see like the first clip, mm-hmm. like the stuff that you played me from Criminal, I was like, all right, like, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, I can't do this. Like the 911 calls, I can't do that stuff.
Makes perfect
sense. Just makes me feel like hearing the voice of the person or mm-hmm. seeing crime scene photos or anything like that. Like that to me feels like it's just too close. It's mm-hmm. too much for me to.
It's hard. It's a lot to engage with. I know that I could not produce stories like this because it's really important for me to be able to like remove myself as needed. And like, if that's like my job to just like bring you story after story after story,
it has to haunt you.
Yeah, it has to. I definitely couldn't. I couldn't make it. I couldn't.
My gosh. Well, Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How can people find you on the internet?
Well, my personal Twitter is Brokey McPoverty. I tweet way too much, sometimes about true crime.
True.
So if you want to talk to me about true crime there, you're very welcome to. And you can follow my show, Another Round with Heaven and Tracy, at Another Round on Twitter and Another Round on Facebook and Another Round at BuzzFeed.com. And that's it.
Okay, samplers, we are going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll talk to someone who makes a true crime podcast that even someone who can't really listen to the genre, someone like myself, can appreciate. Welcome back to Sampler. So I absolutely adore Tracy, but I remain skeptical about the whole true crime genre. I've tried listening to a few different true crime shows, but I always end up feeling like a voyeur, and I can't get over this feeling in the pit of my stomach, like this nagging thought in the back of my mind that even just my interest in these stories is somehow cruel and invasive. But there is one true crime podcast that I am addicted to because it's about a lot more than a brutal crime or a whodunit mystery. The name of the show is In the Dark, and it's a serialized podcast from American Public Media with 8 episodes total, each investigating a different part of the story. And this show tackles one of the most sensationalized true crime subjects, child abduction.
Today, October 12th, I'm 5 feet tall. My whole name is Jacob Irvin Woodline. My favorite food is steak. My favorite color is blue. I don't really have a favorite song. My favorite game is Clue. My favorite thing to do most is watch football. My favorite sport is football.
On October 12th, 1989, a sixth grader named Jacob Wetterling made this recording as part of a school project. 10 days later, he was kidnapped while riding his bike on a country road in a small town in central Minnesota.
It's a case that defied logic then and now.
It is a crime that has both captivated and frustrated Minnesotans for the
past
25
years. On the outskirts of his hometown of St. Joseph, a young boy's mysterious...
It's the most feared type of abduction, one by a complete stranger. No ransom note, no contact.
What happened to Jacob Wetterling?
I've been hearing the name Jacob Wetterling ever since I moved to Minnesota 12 years ago. Jacob's kidnapping was a huge deal here. It changed the way people parented their children. It made kids afraid to go outside at night. And it even led to a federal law that requires all states to maintain registries of sex offenders. This one case, this kidnapping of one 11-year-old boy, changed the lives of millions of Americans.
That's the show's host, Madeline Barron. She's a Peabody Award-winning investigative journalist, and she's reported on sensitive subjects like this before. In fact, when she first became seriously interested in the Wetterling case about a year and a half ago, she was covering another big Minnesota story, clergy sex abuse. But when I reached out to Madeline, she explained that, like me, she's not a fan of true crime stories.
I don't watch horror movies. I don't read, like, you know, the gruesome crime stories that are sometimes, like, in the paper on TV. Like, that's just not a genre of things that I read. So I do think one thing that's been different for me is all of a sudden finding myself in a story that's way darker than I had ever even imagined it, in a way that is so dark that, you know, at times I think, wow, I don't know if I would, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know if I would listen to parts of this.
And yeah, parts of this story do get really dark. You know, there's kidnapping, murder, the sexual assault of a child. But the story doesn't stay in that dark place. I think the show's reporting stands out in the true crime genre because it's not a sensational retelling of the crime. And Madeline, the host, she doesn't set out to solve the crime. Instead, she explains why the crime wasn't solved for 27 years. And it's pretty amazing what Madeline and her team discover. Most of the Wetterling case file is sealed, but through 9 months of investigative reporting, the team pieces together all the facts. Madeline talks to Jacob's parents, law enforcement, and people who lived in towns close to Jacob. At one point, she speaks to a man named Chris who lived in a town near to Jacob's, a town called Painesville. A few years before Jacob's disappearance, when Chris was about 12 or 13 years old, he was out biking with a friend when a man jumped out of the dark and assaulted his friend. Looking back, the details of that attack seem similar to what happened during Jacob's abduction. The real frustration in Chris's voice about the way law enforcement handled these leads, it really stuck out to me.
I was walking on St. Germain in St. Cloud, and a girl ran up to me and handed me a piece of paper, like a flyer with his picture on it. And she said, this little boy was abducted in St. Joe, was taken in St. Joe. And I remember I had like a flashback. You know, when she said that to me, it was a trigger for me. And I remember thinking, you know, is this the same guy? I mean, I was thinking, could it be? Is this possible? You know, that how does this happen?
And did anyone from law enforcement on the Wetterling case ever reach out and contact you?
No.
Chris told me he and his dad went to law enforcement themselves and gave a statement to the Wetterling investigators about the Painesville assaults. He can't remember the names of the investigators. He was just a teenager at the time.
I had expectations that this was hot. Like, my lead, this stuff in Painesville, you can't ignore this, guys. I mean, I went in with that mentality, because I thought, look, this is very similar. Jacob was on a bike. We were on bikes. I mean, just lots of things.
Chris said the investigators didn't seem all that interested. They didn't ask him to do a lineup or to look at any photos. In fact, they never called him again.
I think we all kind of gave up on them taking a look.
When I hear stuff like this, I find myself wanting to know why this case wasn't solved for so long. And despite my queasiness about these types of things, I find myself obsessed with all the little details of this case. But I'm also feeling close to the people that it affects, you know, the boys who reported similar assaults, and how Jacob's family, his mom and dad, share so much more of themselves than I even expected. Here's Samara Freemark, a senior producer for the show, followed by Madeline.
We are constantly asking ourselves whether we're including the right information and whether we are avoiding that just sort of gratuitous sensationalism.
Like, are you doing something that connects people to what has happened and makes them understand? Or are you doing something that, like, makes it a spectacle?
Right.
So essentially what it's doing is the opposite. It's like distancing and you're like gawking at it.
In early September 2016, 27 years after Jacob's disappearance, the investigation came to a very gruesome end. A man named Danny Heinrich came forward and confessed to kidnapping, sexually assaulting, and killing Jacob. He lived in a town very close to Jacob's and had been investigated in connection with Jacob's disappearance. But for decades, he denied any involvement, and law enforcement had said there wasn't enough evidence to charge him. But this October, he was due in court on charges of more than 24 counts of child pornography possession. So a federal prosecutor offered Heinrich a plea deal. Confess to killing Jacob, lead them to Jacob's remains, and only be prosecuted for one of the pornography charges. Heinrich took the deal. When Madeline recounts Heinrich's confession on the podcast, she doesn't dwell on the details of the murder or the sexual assault. I asked her why.
We were trying to really turn the whole notion of true crime, you know, in a different direction. So to not focus on the criminal and, you know, the horrible things that he did, which I think is a genre of true crime, you know, like what kind of monster would do this and let us look at all of the gross details and here are the photos and here's all the stuff. The danger of that is that that can blind you to what the investigators are doing.
And by turning their eye away from all the gruesome details, Madeline and Samara reveal some major mistakes made by investigators. And we're talking basic police work, routine procedures like neighborhood canvassing, stuff that police have known how to do for years and years. Police work that, if done properly at the time, might have helped solve the case much more quickly, instead of 27 years after Jacob's disappearance. Again, the show's producer, Samara, followed by Madeline.
What we were trying to do is raise these larger questions that hopefully people will be able to ask themselves everywhere, no matter where they are, which are, you know, how does law enforcement work? What does it mean for law enforcement to do a good job? Are they being held accountable?
Yeah, like if you look at, you know, what are the big unsolved cases in your community? What are the cases that are being described always as these like unbelievable mysteries? And what is really going on in those cases? And that's where, like, as reporters, that is our job to look at those cases and to look past like the awful details and try to focus on what is actually happening.
Beyond the mistakes made by law enforcement, the show focuses on some major shifts in the national psyche at that time. Remember, this is the late 1980s. You've heard the phrase stranger danger, a kind of national hysteria about children's safety that first took hold in the late 70s and early 80s, but it's definitely something I remember from my own childhood throughout the 90s. A handful of cases of strangers abducting children. That's what set off this panic. In the Dark asks what we should make of all this.
So I think the one thing that people are still not perhaps fully facing when we're talking about child safety is the sexual abuse of children. And so there's a way in which when we talk about, you know, these bad men jumping out of bushes, it's a way to not talk about the people that are much more likely to be abusing kids, which are people in the family, the coach, the priest, the babysitter.
For Samara, the show's producer, this is where the conversation gets personal. She has a young son, and while she says the show hasn't changed her parenting style, sometimes the work follows her home.
I think a lot about how to balance that freedom, which sounds so lovely. I mean, the way that even today, the way that these kids, now adults, describe what their life was like in the early 80s, that's the kind of life I want my son to have. And yet there's, I mean, that the attitude was a bit cavalier. And in some rare circumstances, there is a price to that. And Patty Wetterling, Jacob's mother, has been very overt about that her desire is not for people to give in to fear of this stuff. She has always said that we shouldn't fear strangers and that we shouldn't be afraid of the dark and that kids shouldn't grow up with fear. But it is hard to come home at night after spending all day talking to people who have had terrible things happen to them and try to be a chill parent. That is difficult.
Parenting is a theme that comes up on the show a lot. Here's Samara with some help from Madeline.
There's like a very typical cliche image of the grieving parents. They're martyrs and they're saints and
They're real people. I mean, they're actually
real
people.
And the Wetterlings are actually real people. And so we, in some situations, we put stuff on air that was a little uncomfortable. Moments where Jerry and Patty were sort of fighting a little bit on air.
And when we say fighting, I mean, really what we're talking about is like, you know, competing narratives of the story. You know, like you know, one person remembers it this way, another person remembers it that way. But we thought there's something in the exchange of that that tells you something about trauma.
When Jacob first went missing, the Wetterlings were this united team, Patty and Jerry. But as the investigation dragged on, Patty and Jerry started to go their separate ways a bit, as they each tried to make sense of what had happened.
I was just all about talking to the cops and the investigation. Just give me the facts. I can deal with facts. Jerry, meanwhile, had all of these spiritual connections and psychics, and he was...
That wasn't until about a month after that I started doing that.
Right.
After he wasn't home, it's like, whatever, you know, if straight law enforcement isn't solving it, you know, maybe there's another method out there. So then I went down that road for a couple years of craziness.
Craziness?
Oh, it is. It's crazy. He called it abductor hunting, and they'd tell him to go out on a county road and say something and turn around three times. He'd do it. I mean, it was like, you do anything. You know, but meanwhile, I was alone because he was out abductor hunting with these crazy people. He had Midnight Margie, who I called her Midnight Margie, or maybe you did.
Midnight Margie?
She'd call, and they'd talk all night long, and she was just...
You're exaggerating. I didn't talk all night long. There was always people around here. There was craziness, the investigation, and then about 11 o'clock at night, you know, things would kind of get a little quiet. And I would talk with her about psychic stuff, pretty much, leads. But it wasn't all night long, but anyway.
Because they all wanted some of Jacob's clothing. They wanted a toy. They wanted something. And I watched, and Jerry would package up his stuff and send it off. It was a desperation. And you know, how can you not do everything? But it was so painful.
That tape is so raw. And this is the thing that still bothered me. Even when these stories are handled delicately, when the people in the story retain their dignity and their voices, you're still listening to all of their suffering and their trauma. And it can feel cruel. So I asked Madeline and Samara, what's the point of all this? Here's Madeline.
There is an importance to the act of witnessing. And we see this, you know, in big stories. You know, we see this about war, you know, that there are awful details, like in Syria. And it's not appropriate for us to say, well, that's hard for me to personally deal with. Therefore, I'm not going to read anything about Syria. Like, as a culture, that is not the right reaction. Like, we need to pay attention to people's suffering and trauma. But I think the way that we pay attention to it is a different question. And are we paying attention to it because, you know, we're captivated by these gross details? Or are we paying attention to it because this is a really important thing that happened to this person and we want to, you know, learn from it, or it's important to know that it happened and to make changes so it doesn't happen again?
This focus on the way we pay attention to the Jacob Wetterling story is what makes the show work. And telling the story on the radio, through voices loaded with emotional nuance, you know, the kind of stuff that facts can't capture. Well, that didn't hurt either. Again, senior producer Samara.
There's something incredibly intimate about radio. The way you listen to it, the way, like, the voices just echo in your head, it is a very personal way to listen. And I think it's a medium that really lends itself to empathy.
Empathy. To me, That sounds like a good place to start listening. To recap the clips you have heard on today's show, the clips about the brutal rape and unusual sentencing came from Criminal, and the heartbreaking murder and 911 call by a 12-year-old boy came from Sword and Scale. All the clips from the second half of the show were from the investigative podcast In the Dark. Their final episode drops this week, so check them out. So I guess we have reached the end of the line with Sampler. I will spare you guys my version of Boys to Men, End of the Road, because I think we can all live without it. But I hope that it goes without saying, even though I'm going to say it right now, that I appreciate you guys listening and supporting me and the Sampler team every single week. We absolutely could not have done any of the stuff, not a fraction of the stuff that we were able to do with this show without you. And I hope you guys will join me on my next adventure. This episode was produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Kate Parkinson Morgan, and myself. It was edited by Annie Rose Strasser and Peter Clowney. Our theme music was made by Mike Avellian, and our ad music was made by Mark Phillips. Additional music in the show was by Phil Stansel and Bobby Lord. The show was mixed by Matthew Bull. Sampler is a production of Gimlet Media. Sampler was a production of Gimlet Media.